Stay tuned. Nature News is coming up next, right here on WTZQ.
Join us now for an informative look at the world of nature with local naturalist and educators Carlton Burke and Dan Lazar, reporting on all the natural events occurring right here in wild western North Carolina. From bugs to bears and everything in between, get ready to explore the rich natural heritage of our southern Appalachian Mountains.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of Nature News, the program that keeps you in touch and informed about what is happening in nature in the surrounding area where we live, and that is the Western North Carolina region, Southern Appalachian Mountain area, here in Western North Carolina near Asheville, Brevard, Hendersonville. That is our home location of Nature News. In case you're listening from some other part of the world and you want to know where we're at, and you also, I mean, it's in the United States, the Southeast United States, North America,
planet Earth.
There you go. I don't know if we have any listeners in outer space, but we do have people listen from other locations around the area. So sometimes we talk about some local features and stuff, because most of our listeners are local, but you know, we have to remember that our certain people may be listening to other states or even another country or somewhere else. So we try to kind of let you know where we are here in the Southern Appalachian Mountain region of the Western North Carolina region of North America in the good old United States of America. So my name is Carlton Burke. I'm one of your host educators here at Nature News.
And my name is Dan Lazar.
And together we have been bringing you Nature News now for, we're in our, over our third decade.
Oh yeah, pretty much 34th year.
34th year of Nature News, believe it or not. So there's always something going on in the world of nature to talk about. Some of it is seasonal that we talk about, some of it is repetitive stuff that we talk about because it happens each year, and then there's things that just happen out of the blue that are kind of unusual, and we invite the listeners to let us know about the things they're seeing, or if you have questions about something in the world of nature or topics for us to discuss, we all like to get that stuff in here, so we'll tell you how to get in touch with us here at Nature News and contact us as well. But this is our program for the weekend of May 16th, 2020. 26, and I just want to say May has been just such a nice, May is absolutely my favorite month of the year, I think, and it's just so nice and green, and even though we've had some high temperatures, we've also had some lower temperatures, and I think that this May, this spring, between April and May so far, has been a little bit closer to being normal spring weather in that we haven't had just really high temperatures for very long. We've had a lot of these just typical good spring days where the lows at night might be in the 50s or 40s, and the highs in the 60s. I love it when the highs are in the upper 60s or very low 70s. And, you know, the month of May, everything is still green out there. There's so much blooming action in the world of nature. And birds are building nests and having babies. It's just such a busy time in the month in the world of nature. And it's just a renewal time, a wonderful time, with which the month of May could last for months instead of one short period of time before we go into hotter weather with June coming up. I mean, June's great too, but May is the best.
It is,
in my opinion.
Yeah, it's been a beautiful month. A little bit dry, but lots and lots of days with brilliant blue skies and gleaming white clouds. I enjoy days like that.
You mentioned something, Dan.
Yeah.
About being dry.
Yeah.
And even though we've had a little rain, we're still in a very severe drought in a lot of our area here. But did you know that can be helpful?
Helpful to have for some creatures. Helpful.
Yeah. And the one I'm thinking about it would be birds.
Oh, okay.
Because things like, say, for like wild turkeys who nest on the ground.
Right.
If it's damp and wet, we have a wet spring, they often get problems nesting on the ground, damp and wet. That's not good for baby birds.
Right.
And eggs. And then the birds that nest in the trees, like the traditional birds and all, a lot of them feed their babies caterpillars. Caterpillars don't do really good when we have a wet spring because they get fungal diseases and other problems. They like to eat good dry leaves and good warm weather to make them grow fast, so that makes much more abundance of food for the baby birds, so there's a more success in baby birds when we have drier weather. But then obviously there's other downfalls about not having enough rain in that time of year, because the flowers don't grow as well and plants slow down, and and water sources may dry up and that sort of thing. So there's always something good about something and something always bad. You can always find the silver lining in the cloud. So that's one of the silver linings about a drought situation, as long as it's not too horrible for too long. And even though we're still in a severe drought, we've had a couple of rainstorms have wetted the ground and renewed the upper layer of soil. You know, it's not helping to down deep, you know, in the aquifer, so to speak. But in any case, it has been dry. We do need more rain. But there is a good side to dry weather. It has helped certain animals.
Right. So it's been a wonderful spring so far. If you could direct the weather, Carlton, would you want to make it perpetual May, always May, year-round, every year?
No, because I wouldn't appreciate it.
Okay.
But I'd like it to be more than just a month.
So maybe make May start around January 15th.
Yeah, something like that.
I think 2 or 3 weeks of winter is enough that I could appreciate spring.
Yeah. I mean, I would even take a whole month of winter as long as it wasn't severe.
Okay.
So, but in any case, I just have to say May is a glorious month. That's all I can say. It's one of those months where you just want to go out and sit on your porch or sit outside somewhere in a chair and watch the birds come to a bird feeder and just feel the light wind blowing on your face, a little nice light breeze, get a little nice sunshine, and wear a T-shirt and shorts and, you know, and just not sweat too much and just enjoy being where we're at here in the mountains in North Carolina. It's a wonderful place, and so much nature around us here. We are very lucky to be located in the spot that we're in here, Dan.
Oh, yeah. I think a couple times a year, you know, if you could pick where to spend each week of the year, where it's the most beautiful, there would be a week or so in the fall where you want to be in the southern Appalachian Mountains. Pick that over any other place, any tropical island, any rainforest situation. I can't imagine anything more beautiful. Another time is kind of the last few weeks that we've had here. I can't imagine any place on earth more beautiful than mountains, nice old rounded mountains covered with beautiful trees, a lot of them flowering trees, coming into bloom, the mountains turning green, blue sky after blue sky, white clouds. It's just incredibly beautiful. So I think, if you had a calendar of where to be when, there might be certain times of the year you might want to be down in the Amazon in the rainforest. You might want to be there at certain times. You might want to be in Tahiti at another time. You might want to be in the Pacific Northwest another time.
Dan can say all these things because he's been all those places.
So he
knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, but there are, in the kind of mid-spring and mid-fall, I can't imagine any place more beautiful than the southern Appalachians.
And that's why you're not traveling right now, right?
That's right. That's right. You're here.
Yeah. Well, Dan, this is also a good time of year to kind of watch your bird feeding. A lot of times people quit feeding birds this time of year, which is okay. Some people just feed them in the wintertime. But if you keep your bird feeder out this time of year, or we're getting some reports, personally, I haven't seen them in my bird feeder, but it may just be because I haven't been there when they've been there. But they might not have been there, but they have been there in the past. But we're getting reports around the area of people have been spotting some rose-breasted grosbeaks passing through at their feeders here at the low elevations. And those are beautiful birds that are migratory and are coming back, but they'll be going up to the higher elevations to actually breed. But they'll stop by for a few days at your feeders here at the lower elevations, around 2,200 feet or so, below 3,000 feet. But then they're going to go up probably more like 3,500, 4,000 feet or so up the mountainsides, or even further north for their breeding. And of course, the rose-breasted grosbeak. If you've ever seen the males, these beautiful birds have this great big white breast, but right in the middle of this great big old splattering, almost diamond-shaped, strawberry-shaped, whatever, rosy red splotching on that white breast, and then the rest of the bird is black and white. They're just really stark-looking. The males are absolutely beautiful. And when you see them at your feeder, you know, they're bigger than a lot of the other birds, and they've got bigger beaks for cracking seeds, and they're just like, wow, I wish they could be at our feeder all the time, you know.
That's right. And they will hang out kind of in groups, so sometimes you see three of them on your feeder at the same time.
Right, yeah.
Beautiful bird.
Yeah. So this time of year, you'll see some things like that passing through, and also hummingbirds, of course, are back in our area. And I don't know, Dan, I don't know with other people. I'd like to hear from some other reports from other people, but I know at my place, not only here at the Nature Studio, but my home nearby, I'm seeing less hummingbirds this spring than normal. And as we go into where we're at right now, about mid-May, it's normal for hummingbirds to kind of become scarce because they're actually on their nest. And they're feeding on a lot of insects and bringing insect stuff to feed their babies and incubating their eggs and all. So they're not going to visit the hummingbird feeders quite as often. But even earlier at my place, I just noticed that there seemed to be less hummingbirds showing up than normal at my place. So, and I'd heard that from a couple other people, but you know, a lot of that is speculative because you know, you never know that you, obviously hummingbirds come back to where they were last year, but your hummingbird might have died of old age or might have died in migration or something like that. You know, so you may not have the hummingbird that you normally have there. And then other years you'll have more of them that are surviving because they're younger or survived migration. But in any case, I just would love to get some hummingbird reports from our listeners. And generally speaking, did your hummingbirds arrive on time this year, which is normally around mid-April? Did you have the normal number of hummingbirds at your feeder? And are you seeing many hummingbirds right now, or they seem to have disappeared and are probably on their nest, which is what we hear a lot this time of year. Suddenly I had hummingbirds, now they're all gone. They're not gone. They're just doing their own thing, and they're still nearby. But maybe you, like me, you just didn't get as many to begin with. So I'd be interested in hearing about that. So yeah, we'll give you our contact information for that in just a little bit.
Okay. I've been noticing, I've been sitting on my deck a lot lately, that a lot of the birds...
Slowing down, huh?
Yep. It's very enjoyable. Just a good day for me.
Instead of walking the woods, you're sitting on your deck looking at the woods,
yeah,
right?
Feel the sun on your back, watch the clouds sailing by.
Dan, right. That's what old people do.
That's a good
you
activity.
You qualify as old people?
That's a great activity. I mean,
it's one of my favorite activities.
Watch the world go by. But anyway, I've been noticing some of the birds, you know, that come by every day, they land exactly on the same twig on the same tree all the time. They have a favorite place to land. You know, if you're not out on the same place looking day after day, probably wouldn't notice this. You know, I have a bluebird that always comes, lands on the same branch, same location, same tree.
How do you know it's the same bluebird?
Well, I don't know it's the same bluebird.
But you assume it is.
I'm assuming it is. Okay. And a sparrow that lands on another tree, same place, same, you know, every day.
Probably
which
is.
Yeah, but, you know, you think about that, and it's you know, they really know their home territory.
Do you think they're thinking about, there's that old guy sitting in a chair at the same place, same time, every day.
Well, they could be.
Maybe they're thinking thoughts about us as well.
Yeah, well, they could be.
But if you do that enough, and you sit in where birds are, like if they're coming to a bird feed or something like that, and you sit there often enough, they'll get used to you,
yeah,
and they'll just realize at some point you're not that much of a threat, and you'll be able to get a much, much closer to them.
Have you ever fed a songbird out of your hand?
I've never done that. I know some people, that used to be a fad that people did for a while, and they would sit really still and put bird food in their hand or something and get the birds accustomed to eat out of their hand, or they would put out a fake human, like a scarecrow thing with birds in his hand, and then they would take the place of that.
Or you could
that
take
fake that fake human,
right?
You know, and so suddenly it was actually eating out of your hand.
I've seen them where they put a glove out, like on a cable,
right?
Put the fruit in the glove, and then after a while they, you know, they're closer, and then they finally put the glove on, and the bird will land on it.
Yeah.
And then after a while you take the glove off, and then you go out with a handful of bird seed, and the birds come.
I just haven't had that much time to sit around and do that. But now, Dan, maybe your new hobby, you could
true.
Try
maybe
that.
I should try that. So, I don't know. The buzzards have been circling around a lot, so I don't know what
just
that means.
Every once in a while, move just a little bit.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see what's going on here in the beautiful Southern Appalachians.
Well, lots of things to talk about here, Dan. And, I want to mention a friend of mine was hiking the other day out in the Mills River area, which is where our studio is located, and in Pisgah National Forest. And she sighted something that she sent me a picture of, and I thought I'd mention, it's not an unusual sighting, but it's also the same place you were hiking, I know, a couple years ago, and you told me about a sighting or something. You might even sent me a picture, but she sent me a picture of a beautiful timber rattlesnake that she encountered on the trail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? I mean, it was same area where I encountered a snake.
Right, yeah. So there's that Mills River area, not too far, I think, from the watershed area for Hendersonville out in the Trace Ridge area.
Yeah, that's where I was.
And I know that you spotted a rattlesnake there, and she has spotted a rattlesnake there, so I guess I need to go hiking because I haven't seen a rattlesnake this year, and I like to see rattlesnakes, and some people don't, of course. But Pisgah National Forest is a good stronghold for rattlesnakes. It has a good, healthy population, and like other animals, they are actually protected there. So you're not allowed to harm them. And it's nice to see people that actually will photograph things like that that might scare other people, but other people photograph them and are excited about seeing that kind of stuff. And that is something, you know, when you see something like rattlesnakes and other creatures like that, that is a symbol of a wilderness. And because you just don't see rattlesnakes everywhere anymore,
right,
you know. But here in West North Carolina, we do have a healthy population of them in the wilder areas. But a lot of other areas, they haven't been eliminated from because of habitat destruction, also persecution. But timber rattlesnakes are one of those animals I really associate with the Appalachian Mountains, with the wild aspect of our region here.
Right. So, speaking of snakes, I had someone tell me this past week that they were hiking out at the Arboretum along Bent Creek, I guess.
Yeah, North Carolina Arboretum, that's be over near Asheville.
Yeah, near Asheville. And they saw a ringneck snake by the side of the trail.
Okay, it's not you, normally you flip over a rock or log to find one, but occasionally you'll find one out in the open. Yeah. So they found this one in the open.
And he held his hands like about that far apart, 14 inches. Uh-huh. That's a pretty good size for a ringneck snake. Yeah. Anyway, they were looking at it, he and his son, and then a woman came by, and she had some kind of official-looking shirt on. He doesn't know if she was an employee or not, but she apparently knew snakes. And so she picked it up and was handling it and showing it to him and his son. And she made the comment that ringneck snakes never bite, so you could always pick them up. So I was going to ask you, can you verify that? Is that true?
Well, I have never been bitten by a ringneck snake. I would say that they almost never bite. I would never say that any snake never bites at all, but even if a ringneck snake did bite you, their teeth are so small, you wouldn't even feel it.
Right.
You know, probably it wouldn't break the skin, you probably wouldn't even feel it. But I have seen ringneck snakes bite things that obvious things that they're trying to eat, like a salamander or something like that. They'll grab it. Or if something tries to harm them, they will bite back. But it does seem like with something as big as a human, they seem to realize that biting doesn't do any good. So one thing they do that many snakes do when they're frightened or disturbed, they may musk you. They have musk glands or anal glands that have this certain odor that is repellent to a predator. And so they are famous for doing that. But I would say, for the most part, I've never seen a ringneck snake try to bite a human. Not that it couldn't happen. Obviously it could. But pretty much, that is pretty much mostly true.
Okay, good. Yeah. I just wanted to verify that.
But be sure, before you pick up ringneck snake, that it actually is a ringneck snake.
He was asking me, and I said, well, I'm not sure if I've ever heard that, because... You know, I didn't want him to tell him, yes, that's true, and then he would go and pick up a ring, his son pick up a ringneck snake.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of myths about snakes, and back in my days with you working at the Western North Carolina Nature Center in Asheville, we used to work there many years ago, and you're always hearing these stories that people have about snakes and myths, and some of them are pretty standard myths that you hear over and over again, but there was one myth I'd heard here in Western North Carolina I'd never heard before. And somebody told me that a baby ringneck snake, it's not a ringneck snake, it's a baby coral snake getting its first ring.
Oh.
That supposedly they get more rings as they get older.
Yeah.
You know, coral snakes are known for having these rings of red, yellow, black, you know, and first of all, coral snakes don't live in the mountains of Western North Carolina. And ringneck snakes have a little ring around their neck, and they're only going to have one ring in their entire life, and they're not baby coral snakes with their first ring. But that's just, those kind of stories get passed around about snakes, you know. I thought that was a funny one I've always remembered.
I never heard that one before. But that's folklore.
Yeah, you know, speaking of snakes, Dan, I have yet to see a live snake this spring.
Really?
Outside.
Wow.
Now, I haven't been out hiking as much as I normally do it either, for certain reasons and all, but, you know, just pitting around your yard and doing other things. I've seen one roadkill snake, but I have not seen any live snakes outside yet, and so I'm waiting for my first live snake of the year.
Good luck. I hope you see one soon.
I hope so too. But in any case, with that in mind, let's do a roadkill report.
The unique feature of Nature News, where we gather important information by observing the lifeless remains for those creatures that failed to make it across the road.
So I did mention a roadkill snake I saw. This is actually down in Polk County, down at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains here, at the base of what we call the Blue Ridge Escarpment. It was a black rat snake, which is a very common snake around our area, and they're very commonly hit on the highway because they crawl out and they lie on the pavement and they pick up the heat there or the sun from above. And being dark in color, they also blend in with a dark asphalt and not easy to see, but even if they are seen, they are often hit on purpose by people. But that is not the star of our roadkill report today. The star of our roadkill report today is, I want to mention that personally, I've been seeing quite a few numbers of the possums being hit by the cars around the West North Carolina region where I've been rotating around lately. And that's not an uncommon thing at any time of the year, but at certain times of year, we see more of certain types of animals, which indicate certain behavior. And first of all, possums are a very common animal. They live very close to people as well as in wild areas. Maybe more possums living close to people because of, they'll use food sources that are close to people, like spilled bird seed out of bird feeders that people have out there. They'll feed on other roadkill animals, that sort of thing. In fact, the other day I saw a possum roadkill right here on the road where Nature News is, and it was about a foot and a half away from some garbage bag that somebody had flown off the back of somebody's vehicle. It was in the side of the road there, and a possum come out to try to get some of that and got hit by a car. So, you know, please, you know, when we don't throw out garbage, stuff like that, realize that that can attract animals to the side of highway, which increases the chance of them getting hit. But possums wander around quite a bit in any case, and this time of year, a lot of mother possums are basically restocking the woods with their babies. So during the past month here, it's been a good month for the wildlife rehabilitators. I won't say it's a good month, but it's been a busy month because they've been getting a lot of orphan possums brought in. Possums have been hit by cars, mothers have been killed, and some of the baby possums are still alive in a pouch. And a lot of wildlife rehabilitators are busy raising baby possums out. And also, as we get a little bit later in the season, like we're right now, these little baby possums, which are in the pouch for up to 3 months before they leave the care of the mother, and they climb on the back and then they start falling off the mother, you know, they're being deposited around the area, and they just show up in areas where you least expect them. I think I got a call from another day from somebody who found one in a horse trough with water in it. You know, it had to pull it out, keep it from getting drowned, and, you know, and other people will find them just on their deck or porch or out in the yard. And sometimes these young possums are not that frightened of you because they don't have any wild experience yet, and they might let you go out there and actually pick them up. They might growl a little bit or hiss a little bit, or might just let you pick them up. But if they're about the size of a small rat and they got teeth and they're walking around, they are probably on their own at that point in time. Of course, it's they have a lot of hazards when they're that young, but they are on their own at a very early age there. But it's actually about 3 months of age at that point in time. So a lot of people are reporting seeing these young possums that are really not orphaned now, but they're showing up around the area here. And a lot of the high mortality is little baby possums. And of course, a lot of them will be starting getting hit by cars as they get a little bigger as they cross highways. But a lot of the possums I've been seeing lately have been the adults as well, as they wander around looking for food. And, you know, it's possum season, you know. And there's some other areas that where possums may not be as common, and something like raccoons might be the major roadkill animal you see in that area. But where I've been around lately, I will have to say that possums have been the main animal I've been seeing lately. And that is it for our roadkill report. Slow down, please do not add to our roadkill report.
Okay, there's another animal that's very seldom on roadkill report that we've been getting reports of and talking about, which is the black bear. And a lot of reports coming in from areas such as North Asheville, Hawk Creek, around Asheville, of bears, you know, just being very obvious, entering garages, entering cars, entering houses. And the questions referring to why are there more bears? And, you know, they did the urban bear study a few years back and found out that the bears within the city limits of Asheville, for example, are much, much better fed than the bears out in the country. And the females are having more young. They're having, instead of two or three cubs, they're having four or even five cubs. Having them at a younger age, the bears weigh more, they're healthier, and obviously they can get, they're better fed by going into people's garbage cans, bird feeders, food left out for dogs, and incredibly, some people are still feeding the bears. And so they're finding much more food, much more nutritious food in the city limits, and the bear population is denser within the city limits than it is out in the country. And so we're having all these interactions between bears and people, and I think the city bears are getting increasingly accustomed to people being around. They're no longer as afraid as they once were. When do you remember the first bears showing up in Asheville City?
Probably back in the 1980s.
Okay, I was thinking right around 1990. And if a bear showed up, it was
kind of mid to late 1980s, early 1990s. Yeah.
And before that, you know, even earlier than that, you would have to go to the Smokies or to Mount Mitchell to see a bear. They were not associated with people. But they've gradually moved into the area, and now, I mean, if you were a bear, especially this time of year, what is there to eat out in the woods? You can scratch up, open a log, get some grubs, There are not many fruits or nuts available at this time of year. And, you know, wouldn't it be much to your advantage to go find a trash bag where someone is throwing out old steak bones, unfinished food, you know, things that are much more nutritious. And so obviously the bears are going to gather where the food is. So a lot of these encounters are basically bears associating humans with food. And I think we mentioned a few weeks ago.
Humans as food?
Not as food.
Oh.
That hasn't happened. But you know, we talked about, well, first of all, don't feed the bears. Some people, incredibly, still feed the bears. The other thing is people leave food out for their pets. Like you can have a feeder that, you know, automatically distributes food. If you have an outdoor dog, it's going to be a source of food which the bears can come by and take advantage of. So that's another thing that can happen. Or you can have a water source, a bird bath, something like that, a koi pond. All these are water sources, especially in this drought that we're going through, that can also attract bears. Some people have barbecue grills outside that they don't clean up immediately after use. And a big one is garbage that's taken, you know, even left out on the curb the night before garbage pickup. It'd be much better to put your garbage out the morning of pickup. The closer you can to the time of pickup, the better. And then, of course, bird feeders. Bird feeders are a big source of food for a bear. And you would think, well, how much food is, you know, bird seed for a bear? But if the bear tears down the bird feeder and eats all that high-density, calorie-packed bird seed, sunflower seeds, all kinds of seeds, millet seeds, that's very attractive to a bear. Picture that compared to a bear out in the woods scrounging around looking for a few old acorns, a few grubs in the woods, when it can take a bird feeder and get, you know, thousands of calories in one stop. And so the bears are going to remember all these sources of food and come back. And yes, there are more bears in the city limits than there were years ago, especially when you consider a female bear can have, say, 4 cubs, which is getting to be almost the standard size now, and then reproduce again a few years later and have 4 more cubs. So you're going from a male and female bear, that's 2 bears. After the 4 cubs, now you have 6 bears. The next breeding cycle, now you have 10 bears, but then the young start breeding again, and they get each 4, say the 2 females, that's 8 more bears. Now you've got 24 bears. And exponentially it increases, and we have a bear overpopulation situation.
Dan, I just think you have come up with something, a new, unique way to teach children math.
Oh, that's true.
In the schools, let's count bears.
Yeah.
In real life situations, how quickly they can reproduce, and wouldn't that be a more fun way to teach math?
That's true than just a book with all these numbers on the page.
How about the Asheville Urban Bear Math Counting Book or something like that, and it's all about urban bears and how there's more bears in the city because of certain things, and it's a counting book for children. And we're counting bears, and why the females are having more bear cubs and that kind of stuff. And would be a neat little book.
It would be. Maybe we should work on that.
We should work on that.
Put it through our Nature News Publications Department.
There you go.
Get that out there.
Yeah. Anyways, Dan, it's time for us to pause.
Okay.
And take a little. Well, we're not going to take a station break. We're not going to go anywhere at all. All we're going to do is pause and give folks our contact information.
Right.
If they'd like to get in touch with Nature News and let us know, hey, are you seeing bears? Are you seeing hummingbirds? You have a question about the world and nature? You have a topic for us to discuss? Any comments, that sort of thing? We'll give you our 3 different ways of getting in touch with us here at Nature News, and we do invite you to participate in our program whenever possible. So the first way is to send us an email, the way that most people get in touch.
Right. And our email address is naturenewswnc, WNC standing for Western North Carolina.
Okay.
naturenewswnc@gmail.com.
Right. Most people send us an email because that's just the standard way of doing things these days. But some people still prefer to pick up the telephone and leave a voicemail message, which you can do 24 hours a day. And that phone number, if you're outside our local area, maybe you're in another state, or maybe you're in another country or somewhere like that, it's area code 828. That's the West North Carolina big area code, 828. And then the phone number, 891-5169. So 828 and then 891-5169. Leave a voicemail message for us here at Nature News 24 hours a day. Or you can always send us a letter, postcard, the old-fashioned way. Address your correspondence to Nature News, 3150 North Mills River Road. And that is Mills River, 2 words here, North Carolina, And the zip code here is 28759.
Okay. And I was just thinking, Carlton, when Nature News first went on the air in 1993, March of 93, did email even exist at that time?
I don't think email existed for normal folks like us. I don't think it did.
Yeah, for the first few years.
I don't think so. I think that was pre-email.
That's back when we had the mailbag and we would have...
Our only way of getting in touch basically was by mail.
That's right.
Yeah.
So now we've got the convenient way. So send us a comment, a question, a report, a sighting, wildflowers, anything that you see, a bird at your feeder, and we'll share that with our audience. And one other thing I'd like to mention is you can go to the webpage for WTZQ Radio, which is simply WTZQ.com, and you can go on the program menu, click on Nature News, and you can listen to Nature News live anywhere in the world, internationally broadcast, going to WTZQ.com. And you can also listen to last week's program or the week before that. They keep several programs teed up there, ready to listen to. So if you missed a program, you can go back and listen again. If you want to get a clearer reception, if you're near the edge of our broadcast range, you can get crystal clear reception. All that by going to WTZQ.com and clicking on the program tab, scrolling down to Nature News.
Yeah, so please do get in touch with us here at Nature News. We love to hear from our listeners. Oh, but speaking of listeners, one of our listeners, Joe Nagy, sent us a nice photograph this week of, I think he's up at the Norfolk Botanical Gardens, I believe. He said sent a picture of what he mentioned was a silver bell. Carolina silverbell is about to bloom, but Joe, I noticed something in the picture that maybe you didn't. You were fooled. It's not about to bloom.
Oh, that's right. I saw that picture.
It's already bloomed. And the funny little things that are on the leaves hanging down, from not from the leaves themselves, but from the twigs there near the leaves, are actually the developing seed capsules. And
yeah,
it almost looks like a flower pod is about to open, but it's actually it already bloomed, starting to form a immature seed pod. And when Carolina silverbells have a mature seed pod, it's a little wing capsule about what, maybe an inch long, and it's multiple wings on it. And this is really hard to describe how it's shaped, but it's got multiple wings on it, and it's a little bit wider. The base is at the top, a little bit pear shaped, but it's just very interesting. There's no other seed capsule on anything else out there that I'm aware of that quite looks like that on Carolina silverbells. Of course, Carolina silverbells are common here in our mountain region and in rich soils, and they have these beautiful, they're more actually white, these white bell-like flowers with these bright yellow stamens on them, and they are full of nectar that attracts all kinds of insects. And because it attracts so many insects, not only bees and things like that, but other things that like sweet nectar, they are magnets for attracting insects that birds like to feed on. So if you were a birder in early spring, one of the things you can do is find a place where Carolina silverbells are blooming and follow those blooms, and you will find lots of birds, including warbler species and stuff that many birders like to follow, early in the early spring. But for the most part, our silverbells have bloomed out now at this point in time, but they are setting those seed capsules. And it's really funny, you look at a lot of plants out there this time of year, unless you know the flowering period stuff, a lot of times I am fooled too by looking at a plant and seeing this flower structure, and I'm saying, has it just bloomed and that is the beginning seed capsule after the blooming period, or is that the beginning of the bloom before the flowering period? It's really hard to tell on some plants, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and it almost helps to have a field guide that might show both, or at least know when the flowering period is. And sometimes you just don't really know unless you can visit that plant a little bit later and see how it develops. But I've seen a lot of, particularly on herbaceous plants, I think you see more.
Yeah, so if there's someone that have really tiny
confusing
flowers,
yeah.
You have to get a hand lens out almost
right,
to see.
Is that a bud
or is that a fruit?
Right, yeah. So that's where you take a little closer look at something.
Yep.
But Dan, I noticed that you have pulled out your smartphone.
Yeah.
You're looking at a piece of paper and you've turned the light on your smartphone like a flashlight, and you're looking at a piece of paper very intensely while I was talking. Does that mean that There's something important on that piece of paper you're getting ready to talk about?
I don't know how important it is, but a few weeks ago, either last week or the week before, someone asked if I would write a poem about the sourwood tree. And so on the way down here, stopped for lunch, and I wrote a quick little ode to a sourwood.
Yeah, so if you've never tuned in Nature News before, Dan is famous for writing poems about things in the world of nature, plants, animals, or all these kinds of things. And they're very accurate poems, but they're also very humorous. And so we had a listener, if you listen to Nature, you've heard many of Dan's poems, but specifically one of our listeners wanted a little bit more poetic information about sourwoods. Why sourwoods? Of course, if you know what sourwoods are, a tree that are very famous in the mountains here. They'll be start blooming in most areas about the last week of June or the first week of July. One of the few trees that actually blooms in summertime around here.
And one of the few trees that has a festival named after it.
Oh, yeah.
Sourwood Festival on Black Mountain.
And sourwood is, first of all, I like the name sourwood. That's a cool sounding name. And it's one of my favorite trees for many reasons. But
well, it's a beautiful tree, and the flowers produce a sweet nectar and some of the most famous honey in the mountains.
Sourwood honey. Right, yeah. And so you've got a whole poem about sourwoods.
Yeah, right.
Right. And are you ready for this poem? Are you ready to read this poem?
Yeah, I'm trying to. You can tell I wrote this at night because there's grease spots all over this paper.
But grease spots, were you eating or something?
Yeah, I was eating while writing. So okay. Some poets, you know, they have their own inspiration.
Right, yeah.
And mine's like a barbecue sandwich.
Okay, all right. It was just dripping all over. So we may have a few little breaks where the grease stains are. We might fumble over a word or two. But Dan, I'm going to key up some poetic music for the background here. And whenever you're ready, let us know about this poem, which I guess it has a title like all your poems do.
Oh, yeah. You want to guess?
Ode to a Sourwood.
You guessed it, Carlton.
Yes, it's always something like that.
Okay, let's go.
All right, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, we hear the tinkling of the piano keys, and here goes the music, and here goes Dan's Ode to Sourwood.
Okay, Ode to a Sourwood. Red tree of October, leaning toward light, companion to chestnut prior to the blight. White flowers cascading from the tips of your branches, like white caps of seafoam and sweet avalanches. You never grow straight, you just reach for the sun. At finding the light, you are the best one. You twist and you bend as you stretch toward the sky. Your picturesque shape always catches my eye. Your thick, corky bark protects you from burning. As your trunk curves and sways in its blue sky yearning. Like a ballerina performing a slow pirouette. A dancing tree I can never forget. Oh, sourwood, oh, sorrel tree, oh, lovely oxydendron, swaying and bending while searching for the sun. Lean on, oh, sourwood, in all of your glory, graceful dancer of the forest understory. Ode to a sourwood.
Oh, very good.
By request.
Another classic, but this is by request. So, sourwood tree. We'll be talking a lot more about sourwood trees coming up on Nature News when they get a little closer to blooming. But they are one of those trees that
they're just, a beautiful tree.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're just like I mentioned earlier about rattlesnakes kind of being like a signature animal associated with that plant. The sourwood tree is one of the signature trees is associated with that area as well because they're so common in acidic soils in the mountains here, which most of our soils are very acidic. And they have a lot of value, the sourwood tree.
It's not a dominant tree. It's not a canopy tree. It's an understory tree. But its shape is what gives it away. It's swaying. And I call it a dancing tree because years ago when I was in Japan in a garden, and in the Japanese gardens, they take plants and they put wires around them and they bend them into certain shapes.
Yeah, it's called plant torture.
Yeah, that's what
sometimes referred to as bonsai.
Well, I don't know.
For the smaller ones, when you're trying to make them small.
Yeah.
But they do that to big trees, too?
Yeah, they do.
So it is tree torture. Yeah. At all ages, they torture their trees.
And when I was there, you know, that was my impression, is like these are wired in strange shapes. And I talked to the gardener.
That's not the same thing as topiary.
No. That's when you carve bushes into the shape of animals or something.
That's also plant torture.
But these are big trees and wired. So I asked the gardener, what is this about? And he said, we're making the trees dance. He had two different trees, and they were curving around each other and swaying in this graceful motion like it was they were dancing, and they were poised at this moment in the dance with each other.
What if they don't want to dance?
Well, then they dance anyway. But anyway, it reminded me then that, hey, we've got a tree in western North Carolina that doesn't need training. It's a natural dancing tree. And that's the sourwood. It's always graceful, curving, like it's caught in a slow-motion dance. And so it's very beautiful. And plus the fact that it's one of the early trees to turn red in the fall, and one of the longest-lasting red colors. It starts turning sometimes in early September, and it stays red all the way until toward the end of October. Very thick bark ridges at such a young age. And with the white cascading flowers, it's just a magnificent ornamental tree. I'm surprised it's not planted more as
true.
A street tree or you know, it's a home tree. It's a beautiful tree.
That is true.
The dancing tree.
I love sourwoods, but I would never make them dance.
Yeah.
You know why?
Yeah, they make dance on their own.
I've always had this thing against dancing. You know
oh,
why?
Really? Why?
Because I was forced to dance when I was in elementary school in our gym class, where right. sometimes we'd be able to climb ropes and play games.
Right.
So there was a period of time there where we had to square dance.
Well, what's wrong with square dancing? That's
well,
fun.
For a third grader, would you want to square dance with girls?
I can't think that far back. But
and they forced us to do that. And ever since then, I've had this aversion to any kind of dancing.
Well,
and it's, dancing is just not in my genetic code.
Right.
And well, I would never make a sourwood tree dance. I would just appreciate it for its fluid movement, its graceful shape, its beautiful cascading flowers you mentioned, the insects that love to feed at its honey ports there, the nectar ports, and the interesting bark that it has. And
yeah.
Interesting.
Do you ever,
I would never force them to dance.
You don't have to. They dance.
They
on
force
their own.
Me to dance. I would never do that to a sourwood tree.
Have you ever been to the ballet?
No.
You haven't?
I'm not really interested in ballet.
Oh, okay, because that's, you know...
When you dance on your toes, I don't get that.
That's
not natural.
You don't have to dance. You watch other people dance.
Well, I've seen it on TV, but it's not natural to walk around on your toe tips.
Well...
I mean, people that have that have all kinds of problems. Check it from a medical standpoint. Go Google it. People that do things on their toes, they're torturing their feet.
Okay, let's forget about the ballet dancing then.
Should we torture trees by making them dance and wire them so they
grow different than their... The point is you don't have to teach them. They're doing it on their own.
Well, it sounds like where you went to that garden, they were wiring up so they had to dance.
Well, those were not sourwoods.
Well, you know, here in the woods around here, they dance naturally because you'll never, almost unless it's growing out in the open, you almost never find a sourwood tree growing straight. They always bend and twist
right.
and turn around the other trees.
Right.
So they're dancing on their own. Let them dance on their own. Don't make them dance.
That's what I've been saying the whole time. We don't have to teach them to dance. They dance on their own. Anyway.
I'm glad you agree with me.
Yes. Okay. So now I forgot what I was going to say next. That's the sourwood tree. Beautiful tree in the southern Appalachians.
Right.
Understory tree.
All right.
Let's
so if you just tuned in, this is called Nature News. It's not a comedy act. It's Nature News. And we're here every week for about an hour long program to talk about things that are happening in the world of nature here in the southern Appalachian Mountain region of western North Carolina. Been doing this for well over 30 years now. And we just follow the seasons a year and talk about what's happening seasonally with the animals and the plants, that sort of stuff. And also we get reports from our listeners and comments and questions and topics for discussion, that sort of thing. So we love to hear from our listeners. And Dan, I know that you had a comment from a listener, or maybe not a listener, but somebody, being that you're a naturalist, you're out teaching class and you're around people. You had a comment from somebody about a little creature that is, even I don't really like. And I like almost everything. A little tiny creature with six legs.
Yes.
That is a parasitic, blood-sucking vampire that can do some real damage. But it is something that lives around here.
Right.
And I believe you mentioned you had a question from a listener, or either a question or a comment about something known as a tick.
Yeah.
Everybody
right.
knows what ticks are.
Right.
Okay.
And so yeah, I had a comment or question, I guess. Is this are there ticks super abundant this year? Because several people have been reporting ticks. They've been hiking, they've come home, they've had ticks on their body that they had to remove. And basically, I don't think it's specifically a above average tick year. I mean,
no,
every
I
year
so
we
either.
Get ticks here, starting in April.
Yeah.
And we have several ticks, and they will attach themselves to your body. And especially if you go hiking through a field or where there's low vegetation, sometimes the ticks will crawl up to the tips of some of the leaves and just wait there with their little legs.
Extend. They call that the there's a certain stage they call that, and it's just I'm having a senior moment. where they're reaching out and they're just waiting for anything to come by, a dog, a cat, a bear,
uh-huh.
a wild turkey,
right,
or whatever might come by, and they grab it as it comes by, and that leads them to a blood meal.
That's right. And so they are going to attach, and especially the females. You know, there are a few ticks, like maybe the dog tick, where the male will take a little meal, but very mm-hmm. quickly. He'll take a little bit of blood, and then he'll release and just walking around looking for a female that
right,
is engorging herself.
But the ones that get really fat with blood and blow up like a little balloon, those are the females, right?
Right, right.
And they got to have this nice blood meal so they can lay their eggs.
Right. But some of these ticks are like there's one called the deer tick, sometimes called the black-legged tick, which is a tiny little tick. But it lives for several years, and it has multiple hosts. And so it starts out feeding the first year on mostly rodents. But then in the second year, it will feed on larger animals, including deer and humans. And so when it's feeding on rodents during the first year, it can pick up, you know, parasites or diseases, and then it can transmit them when it starts feeding on the larger animal during its second year. So ticks can transmit diseases.
But a tick normally won't transmit a disease unless it's been attached to you for several hours.
That's right, yeah.
So if you ever find a tick attached, you want to detach a tick as quick as possible. But most people, when they find a tick, it's crawling around them and usually has not already bitten them and embedded it. But if it has, I mean, the worst thing you would find a tick that was on you and it's already bloated.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever found one that's bloated?
I haven't really done it on myself, no.
Oh, no. I mean, I've found many ticks on me over the years because I spent a lot of time in the woods. But never one that was, I mean, yeah, I've had some that were already attached.
Yeah.
But none that were actually filling up with blood. I mean, in other words, they've probably not been attached for more than a couple hours or a few minutes or something like that. Usually you feel something walking
on you, or
sometimes it's just on your pants leg or something like that. Sometimes not even on your skin yet. But just remember, don't freak out if you find one attached, but especially if it just walks around and you've probably not been exposed to anything. And most tick bites are probably harmless to us, but there are diseases that are spread that can be very dangerous. So you don't let a tick bite you. And don't let them stay on. And if they are found on you, pull them off.
Yeah, so like for example, the deer tick, also called the black-legged tick, really tiny tick, that can carry Lyme disease. And so if you find a tick attached to you and it's really tiny, like a sesame seed, something like that, it possibly could be a deer tick. Another tick that we have is called the Lone Star tick. It's a little bit bigger and it has one white spot on its back, hence the name Lone Star tick, nothing to do with Texas. And those, if they attach to a human, they very typically crawl up to the very top of your head. And people find them right on the top most part of their head attached. And so that would most likely be the Lone Star tick, which does not carry Lyme disease, so you don't have to worry about that. And then the American dog tick is a tick that gets on dogs, of course, but can also get on humans. It also has several generations. And the younger generation can feed on rodents, so it can pick up diseases. It picks up something, and somebody had mentioned this to me. I don't know if it's a parasite or a disease, but it causes an allergy to red meat.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
And, like, if you get this allergy, then for the rest of your life, apparently, you can't eat red meat.
Yeah, that would be terrible.
And that comes from the American dog tick.
Yeah.
So, and the American dog tick, I think, is the one where both the male and the female can attach. But the male will detach very quickly, get a little bit of blood, and then it'll wander around on your dog, or possibly on you, and looking for a female that is engorging herself, and then he'll mate with the female while she's doing that. So if you're going to remove a tick, if you find one on yourself, do not squeeze it and try to pull it off, because you're going to squeeze the contents of its gut into your bloodstream, and that's a good way to transmit disease. What you want to do is gently lift it up by putting something underneath its head. You don't want it to leave its mouth parts or its entire head attached to you. So there's something that is called a tick key. Have you ever used that?
No.
It's a little metal thing you get at a drugstore, and it's kind of got a wide area, and then you pull it, and it gets narrower, narrower, narrower until it's just under its head. Very narrow, and you can just lift it up, and it doesn't leave any part of the tick.
I have to admit, when I find a tick on me, I'm not going to wait and go to the drugstore and buy a special tool to get it off. I'm going to get it off.
Yeah, you don't want to squeeze it. In other words,
right,
you want to lift it from underneath.
Right, that
to
makes
get
sense.
Yeah. So anyway, that was the uh, nice breakfast topic we had from a listener.
Yeah, well, it ticks around, and they're just one of those things you have to deal with. But,
yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, we got a few minutes left here at Nature News.
Okay.
And there's a little feature that we've been doing lately. It seemed to be kind of popular. In fact, it's gotten so popular that a couple of our listeners have actually sent us by email a way of doing this. It's something called What's in My Pocket?
Yeah.
And we've just been doing this for fun lately. And what it involves is finding some kind of a natural object from the world of nature that we can stick in our pocket or kind of hide from view. And here in the studio, me and Dan, whoever has it, we have to guess what that item is. And then sometimes once it's taken out of the pocket, and we might actually feel it and try to come up with what it is. And then we discuss the importance of this object, you know, and it just makes us more aware of little things that are in the world of nature that sometimes people wonder about and sometimes easily overlook. Like for last week, we had one of our listeners, same listener wanted you to write a poem about sourwoods, sent in a guess what's in my pocket, and turned out to be a ocapal gall in its early stages that she'd found in her yard. And we've done this with several other items here over the past few months here at Nature News. So we thought we'd throw in one today here. Dan has something in his pocket for me to guess and try to figure out what it is. So that would be our last feature today on Nature News. And then before we leave the air, we'll give you our contact information one more time.
Okay, this has been in my pocket for a while, Carlton, so this might make it a little more difficult. So close your eyes.
Does it mean it might be broken or smashed?
Well, let me see what it looks like when I get it out.
So you're telling me I have to close my eyes?
Yeah, close your
eyes. Okay, my eyes are closed.
All right, I'm reaching in. And let's see. Oh, that's a wrapper of a candy bar. That's not it. Oh, my gosh.
Maybe reaching in the wrong pocket.
No, I got it. Okay, put out your hand. There's nothing that can harm you.
I'm not afraid of anything.
All right.
I mean, it's very lightweight. So I should feel it and talk about it?
Yeah.
I can tell right away this has got to be a leaf.
Yeah.
I can feel the petiole, which is the stem of the leaf.
Right.
I can feel the leaf itself, which is kind of withered.
Yeah.
Because it must have been wilted because it's been in your pocket for a while now. So I have to figure out, it's kind of a thin leaf.
Right.
It feels like it has lobes on it. Does it have lobes?
Yeah.
That means that little extensions.
Right.
So it's not just like a simple leaf that's just one big shape.
Yeah.
And
how many lobes?
Oh, it's really hard. It feels like is there three?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't get that.
That might help give it away.
Okay. Should I guess what I think it is?
Yeah.
Would it be a red maple?
No. Can you feel the edges at all? See if it's serrated?
I can't feel that detail in my fingers.
Yeah, it's kind of wilted. That makes it harder.
So I know it's a leaf.
Right. I know. Try sniffing it.
Oh, okay. I haven't done that yet. But it's been in your pocket. I don't know what it smells like.
That's true.
Oh. It's got a unique. It doesn't have any kind of an overpowering odor.
You try ripping it a little bit, maybe.
Trying to what?
Rip it a little bit and more smell will come out.
It's kind of faint.
I'm probably smelling whatever was in my pocket.
Yeah. Smells like a sweaty... No. Oh, I've smelled that before, but it's not like it was spice bush or something like that was overpowering or sassafras. I think I would notice it, but maybe it was fresher instead of being wilted. I don't know.
That's what might be making it hard.
Can I open my eyes?
Here, let me rip it in half and try to smell it one more time, because I think the smell might give it. Okay, try it again.
I'm not smelling anything.
Okay, all right. Yeah, you can open your eyes.
Oh, the sassafras.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was thinking it might be sassafras, but I know that a lot of times when you smell sassafras, I've had kids tell me when you break the leaf, it smells like Fruit Loop cereal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, if it's a fresh leaf.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't smelling that, so it does have three lobes.
Right.
But this is a three-lobe leaf sassafras leaf. Some have two lobes, like a mitten. Some have don't have any lobes at all because they have three different types of leaves.
Right.
So, hey, Dan, did you pick this off of my sassafras tree out in front of the Nature News studio?
I was way
my revered sassafras
way out in
tree.
The woods. I was... It's not even anywhere in this county.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
I got it outside.
So I should have, I kind of thought maybe sassafras, but I didn't really think it really would be sassafras.
Yeah. But I thought the three loaves would be kind of a, but it is, you know, I've had it for a while. So
right,
it's
yeah.
A little bit
wilted. So sassafras is one of those trees that a lot of people really know. It's really famous, you know, way back a couple hundred years ago, it was one of the biggest exports to Europe from this country because it was thought to be a cure-you-all
Thought to be magical.
Yeah, that would cure all disease and all. But actually, you know, most people probably know it for the fact of making things like sassafras tea, an original source from the root itself, root beer, and that sort of stuff. It is just a very interesting tree.
And you can put the leaves into a stew or something.
Oh, yeah, just gumbo, they call it.
Yeah,
that's what they call it. So, yeah, thanks for the sourwood leaf, man.
Oh, yeah, it's not sourwood, it's sassafras.
Why do I say I meant sourwood? Because you talked about sourwood so much now, and it starts with an S.
Yeah.
So I got sourwood in my mind instead of sassafras.
Well, if you want more fresh leaves, they're right outside by the car's park.
Maybe I'll make my own gumbo. Okay, all right. Well, that leaves us that we're about out of time here at Nature. We're going to give our contact information one more time.
Okay.
And then we're going to say bye-bye until next week's program.
Okay. If you want to reach us here at Nature News via email, our email address is naturenewswnc@gmail.com.
Okay, or pick up the phone 24 hours a day, leave a voicemail message for us, and it's area code 828, and then phone number 891-5169. That's area code 828, phone number 891-5169. Or
you can write to us. Send us a postcard or letter at Nature News, 3150 North Mills River Road, Mills River, North Carolina, 28759.
And remember, you can listen to Nature News on demand by going to WTZQ.com. That's WTZQ.com. Click on the tab there. It says On Air. It brings up On Air programs at WTZQ Radio. Click on the words Nature News. That's our program. And that will redirect to our web presence there where our most recent 4 to 5 broadcasts are archived on the website there with a little description of our program. And then if you dig a little deeper at the bottom of the page there, you'll find that you get access even more back broadcasts of Nature News.
So thank you for listening to our program. Get out and enjoy this spectacular, wonderful, beautiful Appalachian spring. And until next week, this is Dan Lazar.
And I'm Carlton Burke.
Stay tuned to the same station. We'll be back again next Saturday morning at the same time with another edition of
Nature News.